This is the University of Cambridge Local Examination Syndicate, International General Certificate of Secondary Education, June 2001 examination in English as a second language. Paper 3. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, center number, and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you are doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers. And when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the tape back on. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. Which bus should Schulte catch to get to town quickly?
Excuse me, when is the next bus to the town centre due?
In about 10 minutes. Be careful not to get the number 48. It goes by a long route. The number 29 bus is much more direct.
Excuse me, when is the next bus to the town centre due?
In about 10 minutes. Be careful not to get the number 48. It goes by a long route. The number 29 bus is much more direct.
Question 2. Alyssa's youth group is going on a swimming trip. She is reading out a list of details. Which two things must she take with her?
Meet at 6 p.m. outside the supermarket in the town square. Transport minibus, admission free. Bring swimsuit and a drink. Return 8:30 p.m. to the town square. Meet at 6 p.m. outside the supermarket in the town square. Transport minibus, admission free. Bring swimsuit and a drink. Return 8:30 p.m. to the town square.
Question 3. Your brother has left a message on your answer phone. What number do you need to phone to call him back about the suggested arrangement?
Hello. I was ringing to suggest that we call on Uncle at midday tomorrow. Could you call me later this evening to let me know what you think? My number is 055-679. Hello. I was ringing to suggest that we call on Uncle at midday tomorrow. Could you call me later this evening to let me know what you think? My number is 055-679.
Question 4. Where will John be able to find out what is happening in the World Tennis Tournament?
Join us on Radio Channel 5 at 8 o'clock tonight for the highlights of the World Tennis Championship. Join us on Radio Channel 5 at 8 o'clock tonight for the highlights of the World Tennis Championship.
Question 5. Imran needs to know which page to turn to and which exercises to do for homework. Give details of both items.
I've lost that note about our geography homework, Abel. Which exercises were we supposed to do? And where's the information on volcanoes?
You'll find volcanoes on page 298, Imran. And then we have to do exercises A to F by tomorrow morning.
I've lost that note about our geography homework, Abel. Which exercises were we supposed to do, and where's the information on volcanoes?
You'll find volcanoes on page 298, Imran. And then we have to do exercises A to F by tomorrow morning.
Question 6. What is the time of the train which takes passengers to Paris more quickly?
Which is the faster train, the 808 or the 845?
Well, the second train arrives first because the earlier train stops at lots of small stations on the way.
Which is the faster train, the 808 or the 845?
Well, the second train arrives first because the earlier train stops at lots of small stations on the way.
That is the last question in part one. Listen to the following interview about the career of an airline pilot. Then complete the notes below. You will hear the interview twice.
Good evening and welcome to It's My Career. Tonight, Jane Pearson, a casualty nurse turned airline pilot, has come to talk to us about her career change. Jane, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Please, could you tell us something about yourself?
Yes, I'm 45 and I live on the outskirts of Manchester. I currently fly planes for a company called Airway Tours and earn £55,000 per year. I was originally a nurse and worked in the casualty department of a hospital, which is where all accident and emergency patients are first admitted. It was a pretty stressful job, actually. After 15 years in my first career, though, I decided to train as a pilot. That was in 1990.
Why did you decide specifically to leave nursing and to become a pilot in your mid-30s?
Well, at that time, I was working in Bermuda as a nurse. I knew that I wanted a different long-term career. When I was a teenager, I used to fly gliders as a hobby, so I got my private pilot's license. I returned to Britain, still working as a nurse, and studied for my flying exams by home study and a special 2-week intensive residential course.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I built up my flying hours. By that I mean the number of hours of flying experienced, so that when I qualified as a commercial pilot, I had clocked up enough hours to get a job with a commercial airline. I didn't start to fly jets, though, until I started my current job with Airway Tours in 1994.
What do you fly at present?
Mainly Boeing 767s out of Manchester Airport. I do short-haul and long-haul flights. Short-haul could be within Britain and Europe, and long-haul flights usually means taking passengers right to the other side of the world.
Are people or passengers surprised when they find out that you're a pilot?
Sometimes, yes. Some men automatically assume I'm cabin crew, an airline stewardess, perhaps. Oh, actually, this is quite a compliment to me, as cabin staff always seem to be so young and attractive. They're often surprised when they hear Captain Jane over the tannoy when announcements are given. At Airway Tours, only 7 out of 350 pilots are women, but I'm hoping this situation will improve.
Can you describe a typical long-haul day for us?
I have to be at the airport 1.5 hours before takeoff. So, for example, if I'm flying to Mexico, I have a cup of tea and leave home at about 9:30, as I need to be at work for 10 o'clock. Once there, I receive a flight plan, which is entered into the aircraft's navigation computer. I check the weather with my first officer and read the current notices to air staff, which warn of any changes en route.
Mm-hmm.
When the technicalities have been completed, I introduce myself to my 9 cabin crew and board the plane 45 minutes before takeoff. When we're airborne, we use autopilot, and I adjust that as we fly, taking into account air traffic control instructions, altitude limitations, or course alterations.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the crew eat on board. I never eat the same as my co-pilot in case we both fall ill as a result. Then we fly for 10 hours. There's a 2-day recovery period before we have to fly back. On that particular flight to Mexico, we leave at 4 in the afternoon, local time, and arrive back in Manchester at 6 o'clock the following morning.
You must find the different time zones around the world quite a problem when you're flying.
Yes, that's true.
Have you ever encountered any other problems in the air?
Well, in the 9 years in which I've flown for airlines, I've only had to divert once for the weather. I've had some systems failures, but nothing drastic. The main problem for me is the delay often caused by waiting for a slot for takeoff and landing. There's often a queue of us aircraft stacked circling in the sky above airports waiting for space to land.
Yes. Jane Pearson, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Good evening and welcome to It's My Career. Tonight, Jane Pearson, a casualty nurse turned airline pilot, has come to talk to us about her career change. Jane, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Please, could you tell us something about yourself?
Yes. I'm 45 and I live on the outskirts of Manchester. I currently fly planes for a company called Airway Tours and earn £55,000 per year. I was originally a nurse and worked in the casualty department of a hospital, which is where all accident and emergency patients are first admitted. It was a pretty stressful job, actually. After 15 years in my first career, though, I decided to train as a pilot. That was in 1990.
Why did you decide specifically to leave nursing and to become a pilot in your mid-30s?
Well, at that time, I was working in Bermuda as a nurse. I knew that I wanted a different long-term career. When I was a teenager, I used to fly gliders as a hobby, so I got my private pilot's license. I returned to Britain, still working as a nurse, and studied for my flying exams by home study and a special 2-week intensive residential course.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I built up my flying hours. By that I mean the number of hours of flying experienced, so that when I qualified as a commercial pilot, I had clocked up enough hours to get a job with a commercial airline. I didn't start to fly jets, though, until I started my current job with Airway Tours in 1994.
What do you fly at present?
Mainly Boeing 767s out of Manchester Airport. I do short-haul and long-haul flights. Short-haul could be within Britain and Europe, and long-haul flights usually means taking passengers right to the other side of the world.
Are people or passengers surprised when they find out that you're a pilot?
Sometimes, yes. Some men automatically assume I'm cabin crew, an airline stewardess, perhaps. Oh, actually, this is quite a compliment to me, as cabin staff always seem to be so young and attractive. They're often surprised when they hear Captain Jane over the tannoy when announcements are given. At Airway Tours, only 7 out of 350 pilots are women, but I'm hoping this situation will improve.
Hmm. Can you describe a typical long-haul day for us?
I have to be at the airport 1.5 hours before takeoff. So, for example, if I'm flying to Mexico, I have a cup of tea and leave home at about 9:30, as I need to be at work for 10 o'clock. Once there, I receive a flight plan, which is entered into the aircraft's navigation computer. I check the weather with my first officer and read the current notices to air staff, which warn of any changes en route.
Mm-hmm.
When the technicalities have been completed, I introduce myself to my 9 cabin crew and board the plane 45 minutes before takeoff. When we're airborne, we use autopilot, and I adjust that as we fly, taking into account air traffic control instructions, altitude limitations, or course alterations.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the crew eat on board. I never eat the same as my co-pilot in case we both fall ill as a result. Then we fly for 10 hours. There's a 2-day recovery period before we have to fly back. On that particular flight to Mexico, we leave at 4 in the afternoon, local time, and arrive back in Manchester at 6 o'clock the following morning.
You must find the different time zones around the world quite a problem when you're flying.
Yes, that's true.
Have you ever encountered any other problems in the air?
Well, in the 9 years in which I've flown for airlines, I've only had to divert once for the weather. I've had some systems failures, but nothing drastic. The main problem for me is the delay often caused by waiting for a slot for takeoff and landing. There's often a queue of us aircraft stacked circling in the sky above airports waiting for space to land.
Yes. Jane Pearson, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
Listen to the following interview about living conditions for a group of scientists in Antarctica. and then complete the notes below. You will hear the interview twice.
Every year, a group of scientists volunteer to go to the Antarctic research base near the South Pole. It's the coldest place on Earth and suffers the most extreme weather. Dr. Tom Hansen is one of the scientists newly returned from a stint in Antarctica. Tom, tell us about the weather there. Was it really very bad living in that lonely Antarctic outpost?
Well, whatever the weather, it's a challenge and an adventure to spend a year at the research base there. It's constantly dark for the 9 months of winter, and at the same time, temperatures are below minus 60 degrees Celsius. It's often very windy, often as much as 96 kilometers per hour. And, of course, there's always the thought that 90% of all the world's ice is at your feet.
I feel cold just thinking about it. What if you get there and decide that you don't like it?
Tough. You're stuck there. During most of the year, planes cannot touch down at the South Pole Research Station in case their landing gear freezes. You can't escape overland because there's nothing but ice for 8,000 miles.
Oh, dear. How can you bear it?
Actually, the Antarctic is very beautiful. When the groups on duty change every November, Antarctica is a continent of soaring blue, white and green icebergs, colonies of giant penguins, snow-laden mountains and solar halos. I mean, it's wonderful. Your first impression is of light. Lots of light. It's really breathtaking.
Mm. What about practicalities? What do you eat? Where do you sleep?
Mm. We store meat outside to keep it frozen, and anything we don't want to freeze, drinks for example, we put into the fridge to keep them from freezing. We wear 5 layers of clothing to keep warm, and we each have our own living space. Some scientists live in the central dome. That's cramped living quarters for 33 of the team. But most people live in tents with wooden sides, heated with hot air, or in scientific huts.
And what happens if you're ill?
Obviously, there's a doctor on site, and every operation has to be carried out right there and then in the middle of the Antarctic.
How do you all feel after a year at the research station?
Mm. It's funny, but when you return home, nothing seems to be real. The Antarctic weather has a profound effect on you.
Mm.
Barometric air pressure affects you badly there, like a weight continually pushing you down. It's often difficult to breathe, and some people feel nauseous the whole time. Generally, you become tired, unable to think clearly, and you don't sleep well. Scientists who have done several periods of service at the station usually take lots of books with them to study the first time. They find they can't concentrate and instead bring videos with them on their next trip.
And what does your actual work involve?
We record facts about the ozone layer, and we try to study the sun and the universe.
Tom, this was your first year in the Antarctic. Will you be going again?
I'd certainly like to, but not for a few years yet.
Dr. Tom Hansen, thank you very much. Now you will hear the interview again. Every year, a group of scientists volunteer to go to the Antarctic research base near the South Pole. It's the coldest place on Earth and suffers the most extreme weather. Dr. Tom Hansen is one of the scientists newly returned from a stint in Antarctica. Tom, tell us about the weather there. Was it really very bad living in that lonely Antarctic outpost?
Well, whatever the weather, it's a challenge and an adventure to spend a year at the research base there. It's constantly dark for the 9 months of winter, and at the same time, temperatures are below minus 60 degrees Celsius. It's often very windy, often as much as 96 kilometers per hour. And, of course, there's always the thought that 90% of all the world's ice is at your feet.
I feel cold just thinking about it. What if you get there and decide that you don't like it?
Tough. You're stuck there. During most of the year, planes cannot touch down at the South Pole Research Station in case their landing gear freezes. You can't escape overland because there's nothing but ice for 8,000 miles.
Oh, dear. How can you bear it?
Actually, the Antarctic is very beautiful. When the groups on duty change every November, Antarctica is a continent of soaring blue, white and green icebergs, colonies of giant penguins, snow-laden mountains and solar halos. I mean, it's wonderful. Your first impression is of light. Lots of light. It's really breathtaking.
Mm. What about practicalities? What do you eat? Where do you sleep?
Mm. We store meat outside to keep it frozen, and anything we don't want to freeze, drinks for example, we put into the fridge to keep them from freezing. We wear 5 layers of clothing to keep warm, and we each have our own living space. Some scientists live in the central dome. That's cramped living quarters for 33 of the team. But most people live in tents with wooden sides, heated with hot air, or in scientific huts.
And what happens if you're ill?
Obviously, there's a doctor on site, and every operation has to be carried out right there and then in the middle of the Antarctic.
How do you all feel after a year at the research station?
Mm. It's funny, but when you return home, nothing seems to be real. The Antarctic weather has a profound effect on you.
Mm.
Barometric air pressure affects you badly there, like a weight continually pushing you down. It's often difficult to breathe, and some people feel nauseous the whole time. Generally, you become tired, unable to think clearly, and you don't sleep well. Scientists who have done several periods of service at the station usually take lots of books with them to study the first time. They find they can't concentrate and instead bring videos with them on their next trip.
And what does your actual work involve?
We record facts about the ozone layer, and we try to study the sun and the universe.
Tom, this was your first year in the Antarctic. Will you be going again?
I'd certainly like to, but not for a few years yet.
Dr. Tom Hansen, thank you very much.
On the 21st of June, 2001, there will be a total eclipse of the sun across parts of southern Africa. Listen to the following extract from a radio program about eclipses, and then indicate whether each statement is true or false by putting a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the extract twice.
Hello, I'm Tandy Newton, welcoming you to Science Line. Tonight we're going to hear from Peter Hyder, world-famous astronomer and leading authority on solar eclipses. Peter, welcome to the programme.
Hello.
Well, please can you tell us first of all what a solar eclipse actually is?
Yes, a total solar eclipse is when the moon comes between the sun and the earth, totally blocking out any light from the sun. As the moon's shadow sweeps across the earth at 3,000 kilometres per hour, certain parts of the world are then plunged into total darkness.
Even though it could be the middle of the day?
Exactly. The temperature drops and so animals think it's time to sleep. There's a written record of an eclipse which took place in the 15th century where we're told that crazed birds fell from the sky and bleating flocks and fearful herds unexpectedly returned to their stables.
So were people scared by total eclipses in the past?
Oh, certainly so. They were terrified when they saw the sun become dark. For them, it could have been the end of the world, but today we understand eclipses and know when and what to expect.
Mm. So are eclipses very common?
Yes, indeed. They happen most years. In fact, between 2 and 7 solar eclipses take place each year somewhere on the Earth. You'll have heard of the total eclipse in Europe in 1999.
Mm.
The previous one there was in 1927, and the next will be in 2090.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, there's often an eclipse happening elsewhere in the world, and as you know, on the 21st of June 2001, the moon will blot out the sun for 4 minutes and 56 seconds across a broad strip of southern Africa.
Mm.
The eclipse will rise in the west and pass across Angola, Zambia, part of northern Zimbabwe, Mozambique and southern Madagascar. A really good place to watch this from might be the Victoria Falls because of its views and its plentiful tourist information.
Mm-hmm. So what will viewers in southern Africa actually see when this total eclipse takes place?
Well, if the weather is clear, first the leading edge of the moon touches the disk of the sun. Light levels will start to fall. Flowers may then close up and animals might settle down for an early night. Bats may start to fly around and dogs may howl. Stars and planets may appear. Just before totality, or the climax of the eclipse, occurs, the edge of the moon will acquire blobs of light called Bailey's beads, caused by sunlight shining through the moon's valleys and mountains. Mm. These will disappear, and the corona at the rim of the sun will shimmer around the moon's disk.
And if it rains on that day?
It will still become dark, but in that case the best view will be on television, where aircraft flying above the level of the clouds will record the eclipse.
And should people watching the eclipse take any safety precautions with regard to their eyes?
Oh, yes, definitely. Permanent eye damage can and has been sustained by people looking at the sun with the naked eye. Even when you think that the eclipse is virtually total and you can look at the sun quite easily, invisible ultraviolet light will cause eyes serious damage. And if you look at the sun through a telescope or binoculars, it could cause you immediate damage. So use those special eclipse viewing glasses, please.
Peter, many, many thanks.
Now you will hear the extract again.
Hello, I'm Tandy Newton, welcoming you to Science Line. Tonight we're going to hear from Peter Hyder, world-famous astronomer and leading authority on solar eclipses. Peter, welcome to the programme.
Hello.
Well, please can you tell us, first of all, what a solar eclipse actually is?
Yes, a total solar eclipse is when the moon comes between the sun and the earth, totally blocking out any light from the sun. As the moon's shadow sweeps across the earth at 3,000 kilometres per hour, certain parts of the world are then plunged into total darkness.
Even though it could be the middle of the day?
Exactly. The temperature drops and so animals think it's time to sleep. There's a written record of an eclipse which took place in the 15th century where we're told that crazed birds fell from the sky and bleating flocks and fearful herds unexpectedly returned to their stables.
So were people scared by total eclipses in the past?
Oh, certainly so. They were terrified when they saw the sun become dark. For them, it could have been the end of the world, but today we understand eclipses and know when and what to expect.
Mm. So are eclipses very common?
Yes, indeed. They happen most years. In fact, between 2 and 7 solar eclipses take place each year somewhere on the Earth. You will have heard of the total eclipse in Europe in 1999. Mm. The previous one there was in 1927, and the next will be in 2090. Mm-hmm. As I said, there's often an eclipse happening elsewhere in the world, and as you know, on the 21st of June 2001, the moon will blot out the sun for 4 minutes and 56 seconds across a broad strip of southern Africa. Mm. The eclipse will rise in the west and pass across Angola, Zambia, part of northern Zimbabwe, Mozambique and southern Madagascar. A really good place to watch this from might be the Victoria Falls because of its views and its plentiful tourist information.
Mm-hmm. So what will viewers in southern Africa actually see when this total eclipse takes place?
Well, if the weather is clear, first the leading edge of the moon touches the disk of the sun. Light levels will start to fall. Flowers may then close up and animals might settle down for an early night. Bats may start to fly around and dogs may howl. Stars and planets may appear. Just before totality, or the climax of the eclipse, occurs, the edge of the moon will acquire blobs of light called Bailey's beads, caused by sunlight shining through the moon's valleys and mountains. Mm. These will disappear, and the corona at the rim of the sun will shimmer around the moon's disk.
And if it rains on that day?
It will still become dark, but in that case the best view will be on television, where aircraft flying above the level of the clouds will record the eclipse.
And should people watching the eclipse take any safety precautions with regard to their eyes?
Oh, yes, definitely. Permanent eye damage can and has been sustained by people looking at the sun with the naked eye. Even when you think that the eclipse is virtually total and you can look at the sun quite easily, invisible ultraviolet light will cause eyes serious damage. And if you look at the sun through a telescope or binoculars, it could cause you immediate damage. So use those special eclipse viewing glasses, please.
Peter, many, many thanks.
listen to this talk by a student who has taken a gap year, a year out between his school and university studies. Then indicate whether each answer is true or false by putting a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the talk twice.
Hi, I'm Ed Conway. I'm a student, and I've just finished my gap year. What that means is that I have taken a year out between school and university in order to travel around the world. Now that my gap year's finished, I'm about to start studying again. It can be quite a worry to family and friends when you go off on your gap year travels, so it is important to stay in touch, to let them know you're safe, and to keep up with family news. Whether you're going out as a volunteer on an aid project with a particular base in which to stay, or whether you're going to be continually moving around from place to place, email is the easiest way to contact everyone at home. Email stands for electronic mail. It's just like sending and receiving post, but you use a computer instead of the post office. Instead of the postman delivering your mail, the computer network does it for you via a telephone line. You can contact anyone anywhere in the world as long as they have an email address. For this, you need access to the internet, either via your own PC, a portable laptop computer, or college, library, or internet cafe. Email addresses are personal. You need a secret password to access the mail, but you could always share an address with someone in your family. I've just spent most of the year trekking around several countries. My own link with home was through internet cafes, or cyber cafes as they're sometimes called. These are places which provide a room full of computers with internet access, and they charge customers by the time spent on the computer. I mainly sent messages home to say that I was safe and to keep in touch with what was happening in my family. But at the same time, I was also able to email my bank to find out how much money I had left to finance my trip. Before I went away, I tried to teach my mother how to send and receive email at home so that she could read my messages to her and write back to me. She got used to it eventually. Altogether, I received 280 emails during my trip, and I sent nearly 220. Whatever the cost, it's still cheaper than making a phone call. Also, in the internet cafes, I met other travellers who were keeping in touch with their families. In fact, I often kept in touch with the travel progress of people I met by emailing them too. It's easy to get an email address for yourself. If you're going to travel, you'll need a roaming address, which can be accessed anywhere in the world. You could carry a laptop computer with you, or you could use cyber cafes, as I did. There are lots of email provider companies, and most of the services are free. These companies make their money by on-site advertising. If you are using someone's telephone line, then please get the permission of whoever pays the telephone bill before using the internet.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Hi, I'm Ed Conway. I'm a student, and I've just finished my gap year. What that means is that I have taken a year out between school and university in order to travel around the world. Now that my gap year's finished, I'm about to start studying again. It can be quite a worry to family and friends when you go off on your gap year travels, so it is important to stay in touch, to let them know you're safe, and to keep up with family news. Whether you're going out as a volunteer on an aid project with a particular base in which to stay, or whether you're going to be continually moving around from place to place, email is the easiest way to contact everyone at home. Email stands for electronic mail. It's just like sending and receiving post, but you use a computer instead of the post office. Instead of the postman delivering your mail, the computer network does it for you via a telephone line. You can contact anyone, anywhere in the world, as long as they have an email address. For this, you need access to the internet, either via your own PC, a portable laptop computer, or college, library, or internet cafe. Email addresses are personal. You need a secret password to access the mail. But you could always share an address with someone in your family. I've just spent most of the year trekking around several countries. My own link with home was through internet cafes, or cyber cafes as they're sometimes called. These are places which provide a room full of computers with internet access, and they charge customers by the time spent on the computer. I mainly sent messages home to say that I was safe and to keep in touch with what was happening in my family. But at the same time, I was also able to email my bank to find out how much money I had left to finance my trip. Before I went away, I tried to teach my mother how to send and receive email at home, so that she could read my messages to her and write back to me. She got used to it eventually. Altogether, I received 280 emails during my trip, and I sent nearly 220. Whatever the cost, it's still cheaper than making a phone call. Also, in the internet cafes, I met other travellers who were keeping in touch with their families. In fact, I often kept in touch with the travel progress of people I met by emailing them too. It's easy to get an email address for yourself. If you're going to travel, you'll need a roaming address, which can be accessed anywhere in the world. You could carry a laptop computer with you, or you could use cyber cafes, as I did. There are lots of email provider companies, and most of the services are free. These companies make their money by on-site advertising. If you are using someone's telephone line, then please get the permission of whoever pays the telephone bill before using the internet.